Linz, I need to tell you a story.
Okay.
This is the tale of a book. Some might call him a brave little book. One day, he heard about the new copyright laws, and he set off on a journey to find the reader. Along the way, he had to contend with the Brigham Young, threatening lawsuits, and the difficulties of being a book anyone wanted to purchase. Along the way, he was rescued by the brave Zadok Brooks, who took out the original introduction and replaced it with a shiny new one. However, the other copies of the Book of Mormon resented him and...
Wait, aren't you describing the brave little toaster?
What'd I say?
You seem to be preaching a fever dream about an edition of the Book of Mormon?
This is awkward. Is it too late to save the story?
Probably.
Well, as the brave book said, the master gave me a brand new introduction, and I just glowed.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
In the next chapter of our saga entitled, Brian is always in a rabbit hole, it starts with me being just a little too curious. A benchmark, we're working on a catalog. We have this really fun, quirky edition of the Book of Mormon. It's published in 1858. You'll often hear it called the first unauthorized edition. And I knew kind of the vague details of the story, but that was about it. Books are always very successful at waving the red flag at me. Creating a catalog at work is more or less me and the book in an interrogation room. Who are you? Who sent you? Where'd you come from?
Oh, I don't think you're telling people things they don't already know.
Mean.
However, in your defense, this is a fun story. It's not just the Book of Mormon. It's the evolving copyright law. And probably most interesting, it's the intersection of people in the Midwest who are best categorized as never Brighams. But let's back up first, though, and let's bring our brave little book on the stage. Well, the first version of it, at least.
Heyo! That's a book tease if I've ever heard one. All right, here is a quick rundown of Book of Mormon history to set the stage. As you, being the savvy listeners you are, you already know this. The first edition of the Book of Mormon's published in 1830. It's tangible, legible evidence of this new American religion. There are a couple more editions published during Joseph Smith's lifetime, mostly in the U.S., but there's even one in England by Brigham Young.
Excuse me? Oh, sorry. Never Brigham.
Hang on, we're not there yet. Now, even savvy listeners may not realize that after the 1842 edition published in Nauvoo, that is the end of American editions of the Book of Mormon for a long time, almost 20 years. Why? Simple. It is way cheaper to publish in England and then ship them across the pond than it was to do it here, especially in Utah. While Draper might seem super hip and cosmopolitan now...
Excuse me?
You know what I mean. We have sidecar donuts here now. Early Utah, on the other hand, is, let's say, isolated. And we've talked about this somewhat. Getting paper, especially for a big printing job, is prohibitively expensive. So that's why we let John Bull and not Uncle Sam supply our bibliophilic needs.
The next actor on the stage is copyright. The original Copyright Act of 1790 provided for a 14-year-old protection with one non-renewable term of equal length, provided the original holder was still alive. I know how we all feel about math, but this will be less painful than it sounds. If we take 1830, the year the Book of Mormon was first published, plus 14, we get 1844, just in time before Joseph Smith is murdered. One more 14-year term puts us in 1858, just in time to open our big-ass vintage newspaper.
In early November 1858, your newspapers along the East Coast, even the New York Times, had ads announcing, published this day, the Book of Mormon. While that might not have been too unusual, the publisher definitely was. James O. Wright and Company. Even guys deep in the New York book trade would likely not have recognized this publisher, because it appears this was the first and probably only title that Wright ever produced. The address, 377 Broadway, is also the address of a City Directory publisher, and it is possible that that guy was actually the main force behind publishing this edition.
So why is Rando McGee suddenly publishing the Word of the Lord? Good question. I think our discussion of copyright is a very educated guess. It was now in public domain, and then, like now, Mormons were of interest to the wider world. The introduction pretty well lays it out. Quote, "The interest which attaches to this curious work, not only as a literary production, but as the recognized standard of religious faith of a people whose history is attracting great attention, has appeared to the publishers and sufficient reason for reissuing it."
Mr. Publisher had some big ideas for this edition. The same week that the ad started appearing, he placed another ad. Quote, "Men wanted to sell the Book of Mormon, one of the most curious and saleable books ever issued." And to drive home just how big he was thinking, he reminded his potential salesman, quote, "Smart men can make first-rate wages." Now, if you're thinking that sounds like a bizarro summer sales pitch, you're not wrong. So this new edition is marketed at $1.25, bound in cloth, printed on fine paper, like a recent edition of Washington Irving's works. And to me, the best part of this is, to hopefully boost sales, Wright petitioned Congress to, quote, "publish and circulate gratuitously a large edition." This petition even gets presented on the Senate floor by William Seward. At that point, he's a senator from New York, but he's soon to be Lincoln's Secretary of State. Now, lest we think that his motives were pure as the printed snow, goodness, Seward made it clear that the proposal was thought to be, quote, "the most effectual means of destroying the religious delusion embraced by its believers."
Wright would not have corrected Seward because he felt the same way. In the intro, he posed a few questions. What is the Book of Mormon? Whence its origin? What's its purpose? Arguing that these concerns had, quote, "never been satisfactorily answered." The New Yorker was by no means an impartial observer. He described Mormons as, quote, "a singular sect possessed of notions which differ totally from the received opinions of every other class of believers, who were content to pin their religious doctrines to the skirts of the prophet Joseph and the wild romance which was invented by the remarkable personage." I like that. It's a good review. Mormons were, quote, "beneath the sway of an unscrupulous hierarchy and guilty of, quote, holding to practices which elsewhere than in their own territory would subject them to the penalties of the law." Where's the lie?
Give it to him, James. And you have to remember that this edition comes, of course, just on the heels of the Utah War, and this introduction really partakes of the national outrage over this Mormon question. And despite the spicy nature, the introduction evidences work. Wright had clearly consulted several things, like Parley P. Pratt's Voice of Warning and his brother Orson's interesting account of several remarkable visions. Also, as was in vogue at the time, he also turned to Solomon Spaulding's alleged manuscript as the ultimate motivation for the Book of Mormon. And the introduction concludes, quote, "In presenting to the public a new edition of the Book of Mormon, we have thus placed side by side the stories of its origin, pro and con. The reader will decide for himself from the record we have given. Considered simply as a literary curiosity, the work is worthy of preservation, but when regarded as the accepted groundwork of the religious faith of a people whose growth has been most extraordinary and whose fanaticism is an astonishing phenomenon in psychology, the book has more than a mere ephemeral interest."
Now, you might be thinking to yourself, okay, that's interesting, but is that really an episode? And
hold on, I'll take this one. How dare you, Karen? Where do you get off? This is book history. It is brave and it is beautiful. And you might be actually right. This is definitely not the whole story. I think we can actually agree it's not even the best part of the story, because this James Wright edition is just what's called the first state of the book. Here's a free piece of book nerd trivia you can use at your next work party. Sometimes there'll be slightly different versions of what's basically the same book. Here's two modern examples. Rex Lee, BYU president and father of Utah's worst representative, and that's really saying something, wrote a book called What Mormons Believe. So in its original form, there was a paragraph talking about how Ward Relief Society presidents held priesthood keys in their calling. That went unnoticed in the publication process, but then after it's out, somebody sees this and pooped their metaphorical drawers. It silently changed, but still said it was first printing. Then, my personal favorite, in 1992, a new translation of the Book of Mormon into Spanish is published. It's been in the works for a while. People are hyped about it. About 30 seconds after it's released, calls quietly go out, hey, could you actually bring back all the books? Eagle-eyed readers noticed the lack of a letter, one single letter in a chapter heading that changed the laying on of hands to the laying on of anuses. And you ask yourself, why don't we have more correlated artwork that depicts that? They threw a sticker over it, and then they just quietly reprinted it. So again, just different states of the same book.
I have to tell you, there's so many times I've heard Brian and Tim Corey laughing about this joke.
Oh, man. As typos go, that's pretty good. Here's one more, just for kicks. So current apostle Ronald Rasband wrote a book, and he quotes Moses 139, bring to pass the immortality, right? Except he missed a letter. And now it said to bring about the immorality. Whoops. Again, it was reprinted. It's basically just a different state of that book. So this version that we've talked about with this James Wright intro is the first state of the book. Now, for Act 2, what happens when a guy named Zadok Brooks comes on the scene?
Time to back up the bus again for just a minute. In the wake of the collapse of Nauvoo, mass chaos was actually the true successor to Joseph Smith. We tried to do our job back in those episodes of depicting just how messy it was. But if you need a refresher, we did an unofficial series looking at the main candidates in the succession Olympics. But what about the group who opted for E? None of the above. And there was not an insignificant group in the Midwest who, for the whole host of reasons, did not come west with Brigham Young or north with James Strang, etc. They largely just stayed where they were.
Among the plethora of reasons not to follow any specific leader at that point, dislike of polygamy or the increasingly colorful theology of later Nauvoo in general.
And Brigham Young.
These are all certainly very common reactions. And we'll go into a little more detail soon when we talk about how the reorganized church comes to be. But just a tiny spoiler, that's not until 1860 that the formal reorganization takes place. Now, this is not a math podcast.
I think they're called modcasts.
Modcast, right. If it were a modcast, you're thinking, hold on, that's 16 whole ass years between Joseph Smith's death and then, so something happened during that time.
Stories. So many stories. Let's focus on a particular thread. We have to back up even a little further because we need to get Martin Harris into the story. Harris, you remember, was one of the earliest Mormons, a friend and, very importantly, early financial backer of Joseph Smith, had gone sour on Joseph Smith and things by 1837.
Did he desour and, more importantly, sweeten?
Sort of. When you say it, it sounds so gross. He does get rebaptized, but his allegiance is murky. However, he did still definitely consider himself Mormon, largely because of the Book of Mormon. It's almost like he had some sort of vested interest in it.
Martin would bounce around various figures and groups in the coming years, including for a little time, Ann Lee and the Shakers, which is fun. And for a period, he's even attached to James Strang to the point that he served a mission to England. And that had to have been awkward because, you know, you've got the Wilford Woodruffs and company from the Brighamite group who are also in England at the same time. But Martin's actually in England for only 6 weeks, which is wild. I can't imagine enduring two trips across the ocean on a ship to spend a whole month and a half in jolly old England. And this next part after he gets back is really funny. So Martin had just kind of stayed in Kirtland. So Joseph Smith leaves, basically the main body leaves. He sticks around there. And then in the interim, you get sort of an organization that coalesces and they throw their support to James Strang, but then they sour on James Strang. They definitely did not sweeten. Strang is pissed because he's been excommunicated by the Kirtland group. And so he issues a revelation thundering that, quote, Kirtland is filled with unbelief and apostasy, and that it would, quote, be a waste and a desolation, a den of wickedness and a habitation of the unfaithful, the unbelieving, and the rebellious. Folks, don't mess with the tinsel crown.
Martin next moved to William McClellan, whose short-lived group also pulled in David Whitmer. For those keeping score, that means that two of the three witnesses to the Book of Mormon were now in this group. Don't worry, because this relationship was also going downhill. By 1849, they excommunicated McClellan. Control and usage of the Kirtland Temple was a big theme in all this chaos. Keep that in the back of your head.
Mormons abhor a leadership vacuum. We need a new prophet. Next up for Martin is a guy named Gladden Bishop, perhaps most famous as the subject of one of my t-shirts, the pink one. If you're wondering if Martin's wandering eye again expressed itself, you are correct. Next, he published a proclamation that was received through a spirit medium in Cleveland. Fun fact, William Smith, Joseph Smith's colorful brother, was also associated with her. I love one story about a guy who reads the proclamation after Martin gives it to him, and then Martin asks him, "Who do you think it's referring to?" He says, "Well, I think it sounds like it's you, Martin." Martin smiles approvingly and tells him, "It sounds like you understand the scriptures. Sometimes if Muhammad can't come to the mountain, Muhammad becomes the mountain." Is that how the saying goes?
No, not at all, actually. It's offensive. Just one little tangent here to demonstrate again the messiness. During all these twists and turns, Martin had married Brigham Young's little sister, who was, wait for it, 32 years younger than him. And she ends up going to Utah with their children, something that Martin apparently considered himself off and on. He opted instead to stay in Kirtland, though, and in the late 1850s, yet another group arises. Marty is now palling around with a new crew, including new names like Zadok Brooks and Russell Huntley.
Zadok Brooks is very much important to our story, because sometime soon after the James Wright edition of the Book of Mormon comes out in 1858, Brooks takes the guts of the book. He takes the text of the Book of Mormon, but then puts his own introduction with it. So, based on your fancy work party trick from earlier, this means we now have the second state of this particular edition. And sadly, we don't really know much at all about Brooks. We're not even sure when he enters the Mormon orbit, or for that matter, which Mormon orbit. There is a very good chance that it comes around the time of his association with this guy, Russell Huntley. They seem to have both been living in Illinois, more specifically in a little place called DeKalb. Friend of the podcast, Kevin Barney, wrote a fun post on By Common Consent about growing up there and discovering lately that Russell Huntley and his brother actually founded the town. In fact, Kevin's wife went to Huntley Middle School, so he thought it was really cool to discover this Mormon history connection.
That is cool. There's a brief offhand discussion about Russell Huntley and Zadok Brooks in Joseph Smith III's memoirs. Much of it appears only in the shorthand and is edited out by the time it's published. If you heard shorthand and immediately wondered if LaJean Carruth was on the case, you are, of course, correct. From this, it seems that Zadok Brooks, working on some nebulous authorization from early apostle John E. Page, had gathered together what Joseph Smith III called old-time malcontents, along with newer converts, including Russell Huntley, and effected some sort of organization in Kirtland, meaning a proto-RLDS organization.
What's also interesting is that Joseph Smith III mentions that the first RLDS printing plant began with equipment that they had purchased from Huntley. And this probably explains the next part, which is where we go back to our curious little edition of the Book of Mormon with the Zadok Brooks introduction. Later on, Joseph Smith III would say of Russell Huntley, quote, "Being of a practical turn of mind and possessed of some wealth, he at once furnished the means and published 4,000 copies of what is called the Huntley edition of the Book of Mormon. After the failure of Elder Brooks, Elder Huntley had a large number of these books on hand. He gave away hundreds of them, no doubt, and sold many. Long before he united with us, i.e. the RLDS Church, we sold these books for him and paid him for hundreds of them." So this is a little bit of a mystery, though, because it's not clear whether that means that Russell Huntley paid for the printing of all copies of this edition, meaning the ones with the James Wright introduction, as well as the one with the new Zadok Brooks introduction. Did they print up new copies? Did he buy printing plates from them? This is like a serious book nerd debate. There are...
My favorite kind.
Oh, there's none better. None.
Again,
better.
I will always say this. The book nerds and book traders are the big cat people of Mormonism.
Are you saying that... The question is, who's the one that gets their hand bit off?
Then? Who's the Tiger King? That's for you to say. I'm sure you know, but you probably can't say for business purposes.
I will not opine on that. So yeah, it's not clear. Does that mean he's the money guy behind all of it? It's not quite clear, but it's an interesting little project.
What we do know is that the RLDS periodical, the Saints Herald, would advertise this edition off and on for almost 15 years. Sometimes they would have copies on hand, and sometimes they would just direct people to buy them from Russell Huntley himself. If you're truly a nerd hat wearing listener, by this point you're realizing that we've already talked about Huntley. And this was back in the episode on the long, super complicated history of who owned and operated the Kirtland Temple. The timeline is not very clear about everything, but Huntley brought the temple bought the temple in 1862 and later sold it to Joseph Smith III for the RLDS Church. If you remember, this question of the title to the temple was super, super murky, but this is where Huntley came up before.
So we need to actually discuss this Zadok Brooks introduction, but as a backdrop, it's interesting to see what did the Brighamite Mormons think about this original version and with the right introduction. So we do have a letter from Brigham Young to a guy named Horace Eldridge. He was an immigration agent in the East, and it's right after the right version is published, saying, quote, "We trust now that it will go into more general circulation." Brigham admitted that, quote, "We have often been unable to get it even into the bookstores for sale, but we presume that now it will be hawked about the streets by every seller of new publications." And then, I found this interesting, at the end he concludes, quote, "We shall not at present prosecute them for invading our interest in the copyright, believing it will do us more good than harm." Now, we don't have any record that they had renewed the copyright to the Book of Mormon, however. And there's a good chance Brigham Young is not exactly familiar with the minutiae of copyright law that we talked about earlier. That would not be terribly surprising.
You know who would remember Huntley? I bet Jake Christensen, podcast listener Jake Christensen, remembers, because that guy remembers everything. Shout out to Jake Christensen. I bet you picked up on that because he's always got his nerd hat on. So actual copies arrived in Utah by mid-January 1859, and Brigham and Albert Carrington each received one. Young immediately tasked Apostle Orson Pratt to compare the new version against the 1840 Nauvoo edition on which it was based. The whole idea was clearly weighing on Young's mind when the apostle came to his house one evening. The topic of discussion was upon the publication of the Book of Mormon for speculation. Over the next couple weeks, Pratt and Historian's Office staffer Robert L. Campbell compared the editions, copying errata as they went.
And they actually published sort of the results of this study in an article in the Deseret News. And in the main, the Utah readers are pretty generous. Quote, "Having detected comparatively but few errors, and those few are of but minor import," and concluded, quote, "the publishers took unusual pains to produce a correct edition." And this was interesting to me because Brigham Young was not usually generous about anything, especially if it were the Gentiles doing it. So this was interesting that he felt that getting the Book of Mormon in more hands was a net win. And like Brigham Young had said earlier, this article judged, quote, "We trust that many, who otherwise would not, will now do themselves the justice to purchase and carefully read the Book of Mormon, and not, as has so often been done, be found foolishly opposing a work that they have never read, nor so much as seen." Taking an optimistic stance, the article ultimately declared, "Truth feareth not the light."
With that in mind, listen to what Zadok Brooks said in his introduction. Brooks, unlike James Wright, was a believer in the Book of Mormon, but even more dismissive of the Utah Mormons. He came out swinging, accusing Brigham Young and company of apostasy through the influence of false teachers who privily brought into the church damnable heresies, even denying the Lord that bought them.
Who does that sound like?
I was going to say, right out. Continuing, he blamed the Brighamites of having, quote, "for a long time suppressed the book on account of its pointed condemnation of their practices." This was an interesting claim to make. Brigham Young and Company had published two separate editions in England just 4 years earlier, and similarly, leaders in Utah had been pointing to what they felt was a clear provision for polygamy, the chief damnable heresy in the minds of Brooks and many others, in the Book of Mormon text. This is the famous loophole of the Jacob II, if you're wondering. And like Wright, Brooks felt that the Book of Mormon was the best weapon, but in his case, not against Mormonism, but simply against polygamy and its kindred institutions.
So Brooks's revised introduction is obviously going to have to reroute the rhetoric in order to present the Book of Mormon as legitimate scripture. So we turn to proof texts that would be very familiar to modern Mormons, arguing that the Book of Mormon was the stick of Ephraim envisioned in Ezekiel. And he waves his hand at the Solomon Spaulding theory as where the text comes from, urging the reader to, quote, "divest yourself of prejudice and carefully and critically read the book." So with this new introduction, this version of the Book of Mormon would be kind of the quasi-official RLDS edition until they finally published their own in 1874. By this point, Zadok Brooks has moved on. He apparently goes into Campbellite circles and then dies in Texas. But is that all from our boy Russell Huntley?
How about one last fun little vignette? After Huntley sells the Kirtland Temple, he makes his way to California where he's still involved with RLDS folks. Apparently, after a visit from his old acquaintance, Joseph Smith III, in 1878, Huntley proposes a massive loan, like $5,000 in the 1870s massive. The money would be put in a trust fund and used to publish the sealed portion of the Book of Mormon. Unfortunately, Huntley's finances soon go in the toilet, and he actually asks for his money back with interest. It's weird. He seemed so good with his investments. That seemed like such a good idea. Amazingly, RLDS coffers were able to pull this off within a year of his request, so no Huntley edition of the sealed portion ever materializes. But no worries, Christopher Nemelka would pick up the torch a century and a half later on YouTube. So there you are, friends, the story of the brave little Book of Mormon. I'm gonna wind up working in the thick of it. Sunshine through the rain and snow. There's an oily brine bilge, water baptism waiting below.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line, engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up, churning and burning the yearn for the Book of Mormon's report. Powered by Benchmark Books. So this is another one of those sagas where we don't really have a lot in terms of books. There are several very good articles that discuss parts of the story of the edition, and they also give the background for this really interesting period about Midwest Mormons. So first is Hugh Stock's RLDS Publishing and the Book of Mormon, 1860-1910. Hugh is about the world's authority on the publishing history of the Book of Mormon. There is a book coming from our friends at Greg Coford Books pretty soon that will be his research. This article gives you the best background on this particular Book of Mormon edition. And then for material on these guys, Zadok Brooks, Russell Huntley, and the guys that they're hanging out with, check out Michael Marquardt's Martin Harris, The Kirtland Years, 1831 to 1870, published in Dialogue, and Lejean Purcell Carruth's The Memoirs of Joseph Smith III, on the 1880 Kirtland Temple lawsuit and church succession, a comparison of the dictated and published versions from the John Whitmer Journal. That's got your background on Brooks and Huntley. And then finally, Roger Lanius's article, Joseph Smith III and the Kirtland Temple Suit in BYU Studies. Now, if you want the real McCoy, we actually have a copy of the second state of this Book of Mormon edition with the Zadok Brooks intro in it for sale at Benchmark. It's really a fun piece of history. As always, you can get these books, along with everything else in the Mormon universe, at Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by an artist, Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com. And consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.